This morning, I would like to talk to you about rejection. Rejection. Something we don't really enjoy talking about, something we don't really enjoy experiencing in life, of course, but something we've all experienced. I've experienced it, and one of the times I experienced it was when I was a No, this is not like a breakup story or a failed promposal that I'm about to share with you. It's worse than that, okay? When I was a senior in high school, I was a part of a club, and in this club, we had to come up with this fundraiser for a local organization. And so we came up with this fundraiser idea to raise money and give to this nonprofit, and the name of the fundraiser was called Stop the Bop, okay? Second-guessing even telling you this story, but it's called Stop the Bop. Try to explain to you what this was, and I apologize at the beginning. There was a song that was really popular in the 90s called Mbop by a group called Hanson. If you've never heard the song, just take a few minutes and thank the Lord that you have not heard the song. But it's the lyrics of the song are just as insightful as the title of the song. M-M-M-B-O-P is the name of the song. And it is catchy, obnoxiously catchy. So what we did is we said we're going to have this fundraiser where we play this song and it's going to play on repeat until we raise the money that we're trying to raise for this group. So what we did is I took this thing called a boombox, a CD player, and we had the CD with this great song on it, and I took it into the cafeteria at lunchtime, plugged in my boombox, put on the CD, turned it up loud. I even had a microphone that I put in front of the CD player so it would go over the whole cafeteria, and just press a little button for repeat, and it just played over and over and over and over and over. It was awful. It was horrible. Well, at first when I started playing in the cafeteria, my peers were like, oh, this is so funny. And somebody came up and put a quarter in the jar. Somebody came and put a dollar in the jar. Somebody came up and put a couple dollars in the jar. And people were laughing. And after a few plays, people were like, are you seriously going to do this the entire lunch time? And, you know, as a student, you have like maybe 30 minutes for lunch. So that's at least 10 times hearing this song while you're trying to enjoy your lunch break. And it's just playing over and over. So it went fine the first day. Go back the next day. You have my CD player, plug it in. Turn it on. Start the music again. There's this collective groan that comes from the cafeteria. Oh! And then the lunch ladies begin to get frustrated. And you know when you make lunch ladies, I mean, these are some of the best ladies I've ever met. And when you make them mad, like, it's really bad. It's really bad. So there came to the point that day, the second or third day, where one of my peers came up and he just looked at me. He walked up to the table I was sitting at and he looked at me and just aggressively slammed money into the jar and walked away. Then a few minutes later, one of the lunch ladies comes up and she says, are you really going to do this every day in here? I was like, well, I was just trying to reach this goal. And are you really going to do this every day in here? I can go somewhere else. I don't have to. You need to leave here. We just can't hear this music anymore. This is the worst song I've ever heard in my life. I don't disagree. So then I got kicked out to the hallway of the school. So as people are walking to lunch during the day, I'm sitting there. And again, I was in a club. Club means more than one person. But nobody else in the club wanted to help me with this fundraiser. And I'm beginning to understand why. So I'm in the hallway. Have the stereo blaring again with the Hanson song, and it's going and going, and people are just walking by, and you can imagine the looks I'm getting in the hallway. Like, there is that ignorant boy over there with his song, playing it over and over. And eventually got to the point where I wasn't even welcome in the hallway anymore. And after about a week, so many people were frustrated with it, we just stopped, and we never reached our goal, and it was just a total failure altogether. It was horrible. It was horrible. Complete rejection. Complete rejection. Now, that kind of rejection isn't that big of a deal. It doesn't bother me. I'm not losing sleep over it anymore. I mean, even telling you the story was very therapeutic for me, so thank you for listening to the story this morning. But even labeling a story like that, a story of rejection, seems a little artificial. It seems a little shallow. And the way I feel telling you that story is similar to how I think we all feel talking about the way in our world, in our culture, I should say, Jesus is rejected or the gospel is rejected. What I mean by that is I think we all feel like that's something that is far away, or maybe it happens in little ways, but nothing that's super close to home. It's somewhat disconnected from our daily lives. It's not really that big of a deal. And to be sure, the way my school responded to that song has nothing to do with our daily lives. But the way people respond to Jesus and his word has everything to do with our daily lives. It has everything to do with our own souls. And as we've been going through the Gospel of Mark, we've seen multiple examples of different ways that people respond to Jesus. We've seen the ways people respond to him by trusting him. We've seen the ways people respond by obeying. But then we've also seen the ways people respond by resisting him, insulting him, rejecting him. And today in Mark chapter 6, we're going to see examples of those who reject Jesus and his word. And we're going to see how this connects to each individual person in this room and how it connects to the way we carry out the mission of Jesus together as a church. So let's turn to Mark chapter 6 together. The Gospel of Mark chapter 6. You can pull it up on your phone or in your own Bible. If you want to use the pew, that blue Bible in front of you, it's on page 841. Page 841. It'll also be on the screen. Mark chapter 6. We're going to be working through three incidents that all have to do with the rejection of Jesus and his word. And we'll be working through these in anticipation of us celebrating the Lord's Supper together to close out our service. So Mark chapter 6. And the first incident we come to, the first scene we come to, is just a clear example of rejecting Jesus. And this will build each time, but the first point this morning is just rejecting Jesus. Mark chapter 6, verse 1. Jesus went away from there and came to his hometown, and his disciples followed him. And on the Sabbath he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who were heard him were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his relatives and in his own household." And he could do no mighty work there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief, and he went about among the villages teaching. So after, as we saw last Sunday on Easter, after Jesus healed this woman of this disease she had for 12 years, and back from the dead, he travels to his hometown, which is this little overlooked village called Nazareth. And this time he took his disciples with him. While he was there, he went to the local synagogue and he began teaching. But the hometown crowd that he was speaking to, they didn't know what to think about what they were hearing. They didn't know to think about who was saying it. And we see that in what happens in verse 2. Look again there with me. On the Sabbath, and many who heard him were astonished. And this isn't really a good kind of astonished, because they were saying, "Where did this man get these things? What is this wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands?" They don't deny the wisdom they hear in his words. They don't even deny the power that they see in his miracles. They just don't know where he got that wisdom and power from. They're asking the question that this whole half, first half of Mark is asking. Who is he? Who is Jesus? How could he do these things? And the citizens of Nazareth, they're all shocked because in their minds, there's no way Jesus' authoritative teaching and his incredible miracles could come from him directly. Because as they say in verse 3, is not this the carpenter? The son of Mary and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, are not his sisters here with us? He's just a carpenter, they say. That's Mary's son. We know his family. He grew up here. And because of their familiarity, because of his simple upbringing, of his power and authority, it says at the end of verse 3, they took offense at him. So they're not just asking, who is this? They're more so asking, who does he think he is? Who does he think he is doing this kind of stuff? Has he forgotten his roots? Has he forgotten where he came from? He thinks he's too good for us now? Think about why they're so shocked. The reason they're so shocked and the reason they're saying it is because what they hear and what they see doesn't match what they think they know about Jesus. What they hear and what they see doesn't match what they think they know about Jesus. In my seventh grade science class, the teacher had this chart on the wall that he would periodically challenge students with. On this chart were just names of colors written out. It said blue, green, red, yellow, brown, purple. But the letters of the colors were written in a different color than the color they spelled. You understand what I'm saying? So it said B-L-U-E, but B-L-U-E was written in green. And it said purple, but the word purple was written in red. And what he would do is he would call a student up, and you kind of never knew it was going to happen. And it was always an exciting challenge because you would see your classmates get up and fail. Like, man, they are so lame. I could dominate that thing. Because what you had to do is you had to get up and you had to say the color that you saw, not the word that was on the chart. It was really hard. Because once I tried to get up and do it, I realized, oh, maybe my classmates aren't as lame as I thought. Maybe I'm just as lame. And so you would get up and you'd see the word blue, but you're seeing the letters, and but you're seeing the color green, you know, and it's just this total disharmony in your brain of trying to figure out how to do this. And it's the same kind of experience that that's happening for these people in Nazareth. They can't harmonize their understanding of who Jesus is. He's a common man with a common family. We've seen this guy grow up. They can't harmonize that with the evidence they see and hear. So how do they get rid of that tension? They're offended, so they reject him. They ignore the evidence. Their preconceived ideas about who the Messiah was supposed to be and then who Jesus is didn't match up with the facts in front of them, so they ignore the facts. They ignore what they're hearing. They ignore what they're seeing. They choose to close their minds and hearts and only see Jesus from a horizontal perspective. Only see him in relation to earthly categories. There's this verse in 2 Corinthians 5 where Paul says, even though we once regarded Christ according to the flesh, we regard him thus no longer. Even though we used to see Jesus from an earthly perspective, we don't anymore. But what Mark is pointing us is that these people still do. They still see Jesus from an earthly perspective. And Jesus' response shows he's not surprised by this. Look at verse 4. A prophet, Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his relatives and in his own household. Jesus is pointing out this is the same pattern that God's people have gone through over and over and over. Throughout the stories of the Old Testament, God raises up prophets from within the people of Israel. The people reject them. He raises up another prophet to speak the truth of God. The people reject him. He raises up another prophet. The people reject him. And then in verse 5 it says, because of all this, he could do no mighty work there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. It doesn't mean that Jesus was powerless and just was completely, all his powers were canceled out in this moment. But it shows that his miracles were perfect to receive them. Jesus didn't come to do miracles on earth just to kind of bring these really bright displays of his greatness. Like, look how amazing I am. The purpose of his miracles, as we saw last week, was to always point people ultimately to the greatest miracle of salvation through Jesus. And Jesus is saying, if they're not going to believe me, the miracles are purposeless. And the scene ends in verse 6 where it says, and he, their unbelief. At the root of their unbelief is pride. We know better. All these other people, all these other crowds have gotten all caught up in the Jesus stuff that's happening. They're buying into what he's saying. They're believing what he's doing. But we know better. And I think there's a two-part warning for us here. If Jesus, in light of what we're seeing from the people of Nazareth, if Jesus and his word always have to fit your categories, you will always reject him. If Jesus has to come to you and fit in your categories of how the world's supposed to work, who you're supposed to be, how life's supposed to go, what's supposed to be true and not true, you will always reject Jesus. But if you have an openness to Jesus is God, he is king, I am not, you'll have an openness to it, at least. Second part of it is, I think especially for those that have grown up in church, have been around church and around Christian teaching and stuff a lot. I think the second part of it is just because you know about him doesn't mean you know him. And you heard evidences of this a little bit in both Lindsay and Ian's stories. Just because you know about him doesn't mean you know him. Doesn't mean you're following him. The people of Nazareth had a very up-close knowledge of Jesus. But they rejected him. And apart from God's grace, everyone reacts to Jesus this way. Everyone does. This is representative of all of us. And we begin to see more of this in the next scene where we move from rejecting Jesus to rejecting the mission of Jesus. Rejecting the mission of Jesus. As we move into the next scene, starting in the middle of verse 6 and then verse 7, the time has come for Jesus to send out his disciples. And we've seen him call them to follow him. We've seen him train them. And now he sends them out to the surrounding area. But as we go through this part, this short little paragraph, verses 7 through 13, keep in mind this is not separate from what we just saw in verses 1 to 6 or what we're going to see next. Jesus was rejected. We just saw that. John the Baptist is going to be rejected. And here, Jesus is getting his disciples ready to experience rejection themselves. I don't think as we go through this that there's going to be parallels, one-to-one parallels for Christians today, because the disciples had a unique role in the story of God's people that we don't have. But there's still some connections that we need to see. Let's jump in the second half of verse 6. And he went about among the villages teaching. And he called the 12 and began to send them out two by two. And he gave them authority over unclean spirits. He's the one that's sending them out. He's the one that's giving them authority. And what that tells us, that every ability, every purpose the disciples have been given has been given to them by Jesus. And he is equipping them to extend his mission. They're not going out to do something total left turn, right turn from what he's been doing. They're continuing his mission, continuing his cause, continuing his kingdom. He's the beginning of the mission. Jesus is the fuel of the mission. Jesus is the goal of the mission. And that's the same truth that we need to hear today. As a church, Jesus is the one that has started this. Jesus is the one who, by his power and grace, carries it forward. Jesus is the goal of everything that we're doing. And notice he sends them out two by two. He doesn't just say, you go here, you go here. No, the two of you are going to this area. The two of you are going to this area. Because as Christians, we're not meant to be lone rangers in the mission of Christ. It's not just, okay, I have my thing that I'm doing. I don't need anybody else. No, we can't afford to be disconnected from other Christians. The mission of Christ and the Christian life is too hard to try to do it yourself. And it's too costly to try to go at it alone. Then in verse 8, he says this. He charged them to take nothing for their journey except a staff. No bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals and not put on two tunics. Those two verses seem really detached from us today. They seem really strange. What is he talking about? Only take your staff, wear sandals, don't put on two tunics, and don't take bread, a bag, and don't take any money. What is he talking about? I think the focus here is not necessarily on we just need to do exactly what Jesus said. It's not so much on how to do the mission, but more so on the character of those who are going out on the mission. One interesting point here is that Jesus' words to the disciples in verses 8 and 9 sound really similar, not exactly, but really similar to God's words to the Israelites in Exodus chapter 12. When the people of Israel are about to be rescued out of Egypt, and they're about to celebrate the Passover meal and leave, listen to what God says to them. This is Exodus 12, verse 11. In this manner you shall eat it, the Passover meal, with your belt fastened, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. That sounds really similar to, he charged them to take nothing for their journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals and not put on two tunics. I think the overall point here is that as followers of Christ, we are to go about the mission of Christ with, number one, urgency, knowing what's at stake. There's an urgency to the mission that we have. People's souls are at stake. Eternity is at stake. We're to go about the mission of Christ with dependence on the Lord, knowing He will provide. Jesus tells them, you don't need to take all this stuff. Trust I'm going to provide for you as you go on mission. And it means, I also think, that we need to go on mission with a singular focus, knowing it's not worth being distracted from it. It's not worth being distracted from this mission. And then Jesus tells them what to expect as they go out. He's prepared them. He's sending them out with these final words. And he says in verse 10, he said to them, whenever you enter a house, stay there until you depart from there. And if any place will not receive you, here comes the rejection that he's telling them. If any place will not receive you and they will not listen to you, when you leave, shake off the dust that is on your feet as a testimony against them. He says, as you go about preaching the gospel, there will be people in places that receive you. There will be people in places that reject you. And Christians today face the same two outcomes. We've seen these in recent stories in Mark. We've seen those that have received Christ. We've seen those that have rejected Christ. Rico Tice, in his book, Honest Evangelism, he calls it, there's going to be hunger and there's going to be hostility. There will be hunger and there will be hostility. And as the people of God, we should expect both as we go about living for Christ. Rico Tice explains it this way in his book. He says, we must be honest about the hostility, or we'll have wrong expectations and give up on evangelism. But we must also be excited about the hunger, or we'll have no expectations at all and never start evangelism. Hostility and hunger. That's what you'll find as you tell others about Jesus. And you have to risk the hostility to discover the hunger. So as you think about who's your one, we've been challenging all of us to pray for one person that we don't know, that we know that doesn't know Christ. And maybe as you pray about that person and you've tried to talk to that person, maybe you've experienced that hostility or that rejection. Maybe it's been shoved away. But I would say expect the hostility, expect the rejection, expect the hunger, expect people to receive Christ. Keep praying. Keep asking them questions. Keep speaking the gospel. And you and I are going to be rejected as we speak about Jesus. But we endure those who reject Jesus because we know there will also be those who God leads to receive Jesus. And sometimes, as maybe many of your stories could share, sometimes the very people who at first reject Jesus, God by His grace turns their hearts to receive Jesus. Because amidst the hostility, there will be hunger. There will be. And as we go to our final scene this morning, we see the type of courage that's called for in the midst of the rejection. The last point this morning, as we get ready to move toward the Lord's Supper, is rejecting the way of Jesus. Rejecting the way of Jesus. This next story is going to seem out of place and random, but it flows out of all that we've read so far. we read about Jesus just sending out the 12 disciples. And you see down in verse 30, they come back and start talking about everything that's happened. But there's this story about John the Baptist's death in between. Jesus was rejected. The disciples were going to be rejected at times. We're about to read of John the Baptist facing the ultimate rejection. And I think Mark puts this story here so that the church in his day and the church in our day could learn how to count the cost of following Christ. So you should receive Christ, but be prepared that it sometimes means being rejected. And you should believe in Jesus, but be prepared to face pushback from those who don't believe. The reputation of Jesus has been spreading as he does miracles, as he teaches, as he sends out his disciples. And that reputation, those stories, eventually make their way all the way to the political rulers of the day. Let's jump in at verse 14. King Herod heard of it, of what Jesus was doing, for Jesus' name had become known. And some said, John the Baptist has been raised from the dead. That's why these miraculous powers are at work in him. Others said, he's Elijah. And others said, he's a prophet, like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard of it, he said, John, whom I beheaded, has been raised. As the stories of Jesus are spreading, people respond with different hypotheses. Some say it's Elijah, some say it's an Old Testament prophet, but Herod says, no, this has to be John the Baptist coming back from the dead. Jesus' ministry is so similar to John's ministry that Herod wonders if it's the same guy. But this similarity doesn't exist by accident, because prophets like Elijah in the Old Testament, prophets like John the Baptist, through their preaching, through their way of life, are pointing to a very specific type of Messiah, are pointing to Jesus himself. So what this means is that Mark isn't using this story just to tell us something about Herod. He's not using this story just to tell us something about John. He's using this story to tell us something about Jesus. And Herod just said that John the Baptist has been beheaded. And as you're reading through the book of Mark, that's news here. We didn't know that. Last we read of John the Baptist was all the way back in chapter 1, where he was preaching, he was baptizing. You read this really small blurb in chapter 1, verse 14, that talks about John the Baptist being arrested. But then you don't hear about him after that. So what happens starting in verse 17 is Mark gives us this flashback to how everything unfolded and came to the point where it was. Here's what it says in verse 17. For it was Herod who had sent and seized John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because he had married her. For John had been saying to Herod, it's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. And Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to put him to death. But she could not, for Herod feared John, knowing he was a righteous and holy man, and he kept him safe. When he heard him, he was greatly perplexed, and yet he heard him gladly. So Herod put John in prison because his wife Herodias wanted him to. It's a way of protecting John in some ways. Well, what did she have against John? Well, as we just read, John had been telling Herod repeatedly, Herod, you can't marry your brother's wife. That goes against God's commands. That goes against God's way. You're breaking God's commands when you do that. And John was calling Herod to turn from that sin and turn to the Lord and walk in his ways. When Herodias didn't like what John was saying, she wanted him killed. But she couldn't have him killed because, crazy enough, her husband Herod respected the man. There was something about John that he liked. And did you notice that? It says it in verse 20, Herod feared John, knowing he was a righteous and holy man, and he kept him safe. And then a very interesting note there at the end of the verse, when he heard him, he was greatly perplexed, and yet he heard him gladly. Because John walked in the way of Jesus and spoke the truth of Jesus, it caught Herod's attention. It piqued his interest. And the courage and conviction that we see in John is a clear example of what it looks like to follow Jesus in a world that rejects him. John is living out the character in the life that Jesus just taught the disciples earlier. Because a faithful Christian will both, hear me, both attract lost people and repel them away. both. If the version of Christianity we are living only turns people away, we're not walking in the way of Jesus. But if the version of Christianity we are living only draws people in, we're not walking in the way of Jesus either. Faithfulness to King Jesus, faithfulness to his mission, will cause both. Some to receive Christ, some to reject him. And we see that that kind of faithfulness in John the Baptist, it doesn't make you immune to danger. It doesn't make you immune to harm. Because what happens next is Herodias finally sees this opportunity to capitalize on what's happening with John. Herod has this birthday party. And at the birthday party, his stepdaughter has all these military commanders, all these big high-up guys that are there. And at the birthday party, his stepdaughter, Herodias' daughter, comes to dance for everyone. And when Herod gets all caught up on what's going on in this moment, he tells Herodias' daughter, whatever you want, I'll give it to you. You just name it. I'll give you whatever you want. His passions and his desires are taking over and getting the best of him. And then jump in with me at verse 24 to see what she says. She went out and said to her mother, what should I ask? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. And she came in immediately with haste to the king and asked, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And the king was exceedingly sorry, but because of his oaths and his guests, he did not want to break his word to her. And immediately the king sent an executioner with orders to bring John's head. He went and beheaded him in the prison and brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. And when his disciples heard of it, they came and took his body and laid it in a tomb. John paid the ultimate price for the cause of Christ. He was so rooted in the promises of God and the truths of God's word. He was convinced that Jesus was who he says he was, and he thought Jesus was worth it. He was willing to follow that truth all the way to the death. And he stands in a long line of other Christians that have done the same thing throughout the history of the church. Names we know, names we will never know until we get to heaven. So it just makes us ask that and understand that costly ministry like this, rejection like this, is the norm in Christianity. It's not the exception. And the norm isn't set for us just by John and then later some of the apostles. The norm is set for us by Christ himself. Because we need more Christians who are willing to count the cost and follow Christ regardless. Do we want to be known for a church that loves our own reputation more than we love our Savior? Wouldn't we rather be a church that's known for caring more about lost souls than we do about our own comfort? Wouldn't we want to be a church that is known for holding the truth of Jesus as more important than our very own lives? John's death here foreshadows Jesus' death. And it's just a prediction that something else is coming for Christ. Both were killed, though they were both innocent. Both were killed by Roman rulers who were pressured into an execution. Both of their deaths also point to the fact that death does not defeat God's cause. It did not happen with John the Baptist. The truth kept spreading. It did not happen when Jesus died, because as we celebrated last week, he came back to life, and the message of his gospel hasn't gone silent since. So as we go out on the mission of Jesus, rejection's inevitable. But because of the saving work of Jesus, it's not just that rejection's inevitable, redemption is inevitable. Suffering will come, but so will salvation. And we're going to reflect on both of these as we come to the Lord's table together. So let's pray, and then we'll celebrate the Lord's Supper to wrap up our service.